Okay. Ready to get started. So the topic this week is addressing child molestation cases from the perspective of Beis Din, a very serious and weighty issue. We know that there have been cases that were pretty well publicized over the years. Even a recent case of somebody who was a child's book author and was subject to all kinds of accusations in the middle of a Beis Din investigation regarding a number of the accusations. The person apparently took his own life, so it was a case that was never really concluded, but there were all kinds of questions afterwards, even while the investigation was taking place, about whether it was appropriate to read the person's books and what exactly do you tell your children. And there were other cases of people who are either counselors or educators who are accused of molesting children. And some of the cases, unfortunately, have a real sound basis. And the question is, how does Beis Din deal with the cases of this magnitude, cases really that have a criminal component to them? They could also have a monetary component. You have a person who is traumatized by virtue of either molestation or other type of inappropriate activity, and they have to go through a lifetime of therapy. Can they bring the offending party to Beis Din to recover medical bills, therapy bills, things of that variety? So what exactly is the jurisdiction of Beis Din when it comes to these matters? So there's really, a number of questions. One question is, what is the nature of Beis Din jurisdiction, Ms. Manazeh? Another question is, if there isn't Beis Din jurisdiction, are these cases that are appropriate to give over to criminal authorities? What about the prohibition of Mesira, that you're not supposed to hand a Jewish offender over to criminal authorities? So is that something which is pertinent when it comes to these type of cases? Is it pertinent nowadays altogether? So there was really a forum to discuss these topics a number of years ago when it was clear that there were a number of disturbing cases in the community that needed to be addressed. And there were various poskim who were consulted about this, including the late Rizalman Nechemia Goldberg and the late Rav Elyashiv. And other Yibadlu L'chaim Tovim, poskim of today, such as Rav Asher Weiss, Rav Yehuda Silman. Rav Yehuda Silman was actually involved in this most recent case regarding the children's book author, and Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein, and a number, and Rav Moshe Halberstam, a number of the responses of these various dayanim, these various poskim, were published in the journal Yeshurun a number of years ago. And I suppose that Rav Elyashiv's response was probably given the greatest weight because he was considered, towards the last number of years of his life, he was considered the Gadol Hador by many. What did Rav Elyashiv have to say about this subject, about turning over child molesters? And there are really three different categories when we speak about child molesters. And this is where it gets, fuzzy and complicated, and where it becomes a double-edged sword to some degree. And that is, you have your vadai cases, the cases where the person is, for whatever reason, we know, based on testimony, based on overwhelming evidence, there's no question that the person is guilty of molestation. There's no question that the person has to be stopped in their tracks from committing further molestation, where it would be sort of in vadai category. And then you have what would be called raglayim ledavar category, where there is circumstantial evidence, even perhaps strong circumstantial evidence, but not to the degree where you could say bevados, that it's an absolute certainty that the molestation is taking place. It seems like a pretty reasonable supposition based on the testimony that's being rendered, based on some of the accusations that are being made, and based on some of the circumstantial evidence. And then you have sort of your third category, where there's not even raglayim ledavar, where there's not even really what you could call circumstantial evidence, just somebody makes an allegation, but it doesn't appear to be backed up by any facts, any data, any corroborating evidence whatsoever. So it's very difficult to lump this all together. And within molestation, there's molestation which is extremely intense, so extremely violative, where, for example, there's somebody who's sodomizing children or raping young girls and things of that sort. And then you have cases where a person is simply inappropriately maybe patting students on the back or giving them a pat on the cheek after they answer a question properly or something like that, and people complain, this isn't really the way that a teacher should be behaving. But nobody really thinks that the teacher is, for example, taking children home and sleeping in their bed with the children or anything of that sort. So there are also different levels of what might be called inappropriate touching or, inappropriate interaction that might not be the same type of full-fledged molestation. One of the difficult issues for dayanim to have to deal with, for communities to have to deal with, is that many people sort of lump all of these cases together in one sort of painting everything with one broad brush. And if you're really going to be a careful and a judicious dayan, then you have to recognize that there are, different there are distinctions, there are differentiations between different types of cases. And then there's the whole category of child molestation, where it's quite clear that there are non-negotiables, shall we say, that there's no such thing as ever justifiably molesting a child. You say, "Well, I was molesting the child in order to teach them." So, no, you can't molest the child. There's never any justification. And then there's sort of a whole separate category of child abuse. Child abuse, meaning that you have somebody who is hitting a child, who's causing wounds upon a child, who's injuring a child on a regular basis, where there is a sustained pattern of child abuse. So parents sometimes, for example, if you're dealing with a parent, sometimes will discipline a child, and sometimes a parent will make a mistake and discipline a child too much, and sometimes a parent is harried and has 10 children, particularly in very religious communities where you attend, like places where there's more of a custom, shall we say, to have very large families, and maybe you'll have a harried mother who will forget a child in the car for 5 minutes. Okay, nothing will happen, but you have a neighbor who sees the child was left in the car. So does that mean that this parent was guilty of child abuse and that the child has to be taken away from the parent? So that's sort of in its category of its own. On the other hand, there are cases of child abuse that clearly are egregious and where the child's life is in danger, and where the parent is very willfully and maliciously injuring and hurting a child, where it is appropriate for the parent to be disciplined and for the child to be taken away from the parent. So that's sort of in its own category. It's easier, in a way, to speak about child molestation without speaking about child abuse at the same time, but child abuse is also part of the cheshbon. So there are a few different sources that the poskim cited in this Yeshurun journal that dealt with the question of, can you turn over a child molested to the authorities? And the starting point really is that Bati Din, rabbinical courts nowadays, as we've discussed on a number of occasions, they have really monetary jurisdiction, that we have jurisdiction to be able to decide, adjudicate monetary disputes between the Jews. It doesn't matter. We've discussed recently partnership disputes, landlord-tenant disputes, employment disputes, all kinds of disputes, inheritance disputes, disputes in all of those different arenas. And we have authority given to us by the Torah. We are considered to be the agents on some level of the dayanim, of the judges of yesteryear, in terms of carrying out that authority in whatever measure, and that has to do with monetary cases. But what about criminal cases? Does Beis Din have jurisdiction over criminal cases? So if you look at the first source in the packet, and we're not going to go through every single source in the packet at length. I'll try to keep this to under an hour for this evening. Please hold me to that. That the very first source in Sanhedrin Daf Mem Vav Amud Aleph speaks about Tanya Rabbi Eliezer Miyakov Omer Shemati Shebeis Din Makim Bonshin Shalom in the Torah. The Beis Din does have extrajudicial powers in order to be able to maintain law and order. As it says, Lo Lavo Divrei Torah. Beis Din has the ability to institute punishments, to have criminal jurisdiction over people, even to punish not in accordance with the laws of the Torah. Like, for example, we don't have the ability to give capital punishment when there's no Sanhedrin sitting in the Beis HaMikdash in Lishkas HaGazis. But nonetheless, there are cases that are described in the Gemara where Beis Din in latter days put somebody to death, and lo lavo divrei Torah, not to go against the Torah, ela kedei laso siyag l'Torah, but in order to maintain law and order, so you'll have a Torah abiding society. And this is all codified in the Shulchan Aruch, in Choshen Mishpat, actually the second siman of Shulchan Aruch. We've touched upon this in the past, that if you have a bezdin, even if it's not smuchim, you look at the source number two from the Shulchan Aruch, even if it's not a classic bezdin from the hasmicha that was passed down from Moshe Rabbeinu, imoyim sha'am prutzim barveiro shutzarech sha'ach, they see that the people are simply running, you know, amok in terms of ignoring laws of Torah, and society is breaking down into chaos. Hayudanim ben misa ben mamon, they have the ability to impose all kinds of punishments, death penalty, to impose monetary penalties that may not otherwise even be warranted according to the Torah. Even if the evidentiary standards of the Torah have not been fully met. So there's sort of a double type of a dispensation given to Bezdin in order to maintain law and order. One is to impose punishments that they may not otherwise be authorized to impose according to Torah law. And number two, to rely upon evidence, like, for example, according to Torah law, you generally need two kosher witnesses to testify about something. So here, even if you have very strong circumstantial evidence, you don't have Edus Gemura, so that's considered to be good enough. This is all based on Shuvas of the Rashba, where the Rashba talks about this type of jurisdiction that Bezdin can have. This is found in Chela Gimel, Simen Shin Sadi Gimel in the Rashba, and another Rashba, which is cited by the Beis Yosef and Simon Shin Peches in Choshen Mishpat, a couple of different places where the Rashba talks about this. And you look at the last of two words in the Shulchan Aruch citation in Simon Beis, it's Lemigdar Milsa. Lemigdar Milsa simply means in order to maintain a sense of order in society, what might even be called a Tikkun Olam. For what we talk about Tikkun Olam, and this is a wonderful value. So Tikkun Olam sometimes means that you have to be able to be tough, and you need to be able to impose law and order, and to have punishments that may not necessarily be completely in accordance with Torah law. The Torah in source number three actually says that you have the ability to also utilize the secular courts for this purpose. What does that mean? It means that if the Bezdin is not going to be strong enough to carry out this type of administration of law and order in society on its own, in Mu'alam, you have, for example, strong men who are not going to otherwise listen to the Bezdin. Choftim oso ayidei akum, so then you can even go to the non-Jewish courts, and let them impose the punishments that we otherwise would have imposed ourselves. You look at source four, the Beis Yosef quotes this all from the Rashba, that you can appoint the individuals, you can appoint those who are going to have this type of authority. It explains the Rashba, this is line number two, in the middle of the line, v'zeh mikiyum ha'olam. It's for purposes of keeping the world standing, keeping the world standing. What keeps the world standing? Al din ve'al emes ve'al ha'shalom, right? Al shlosha dvarim ha'olam kayem, the world remains standing. If you have din and emes and shalom, this is a form of din. Imakin ve'onshin shalom in a din is a form of din of justice. Shima tem amidim ha'kol al din maksum b'Torah. If you leave things exactly as they are stipulated in the Torah, shalasas l'masha ansha Torah, and only punish according to what the Torah allows you to, nimsa olam chariv. So then the whole world is going to become destroyed. You're going to require witnesses and warnings with respect to putting any type of punishment into place. And this is the meaning, says the Rashba, interestingly enough, of Lo Chava Yerushalayim El Hashemidu Dineim Al Din Torah. The Yerushalayim was only destroyed because they insisted on following the strict letter of the law. We generally understand that Gemara and Bava Metzia is meaning that people weren't going above and beyond the letter of the law. They were insisting on getting every single penny. If somebody owed them $1,000, they said, I want every single penny, I'm not going to compromise at all. That's one understanding of why Yerushalayim was destroyed. The Rashba says it was destroyed because they weren't maintaining criminal law in order, because people were violating laws of the Torah. It could be they were violating murder, and they were violating arayas of prohibited relationships and the like, and you didn't have proper witnesses, and you didn't have the ability to impose a punishment, and as a result, there was a complete breakdown in law and order, and that's why you need for Bezdin to be able to exercise these extrajudicial powers. This sense of extrajudicial power, which the Torah says can be handed over to the secular courts, is really, if you look at source above on page 2 to jump for a second, is really a function of a governmental responsibility, according to the Dvar Avraham. According to the Kavanah Rav, the Dvar Avraham, he says this is really governmental responsibility. This whole idea, he says, Amakin Ve'onshin, we're going to skip to the last two lines. I give you the entire citation so you can take it home, and at your leisure, you can read the entire, you know, citation and, you know, digest it and take it all in. But this is, you know, intended to be a shorter, you know, shiur, so we'll just, you know, focus on the essence of, you know, the point that he's making. So look at the last two lines of Al Kochok, Tzarek Lomar, Shuim Mishpatei HaMelucha. You have to say that this is really governmental function. The idea of maintaining law in society to make sure that people don't run amok, violating all kinds of laws because you're not going to satisfy the evidentiary requirements to be able to punish them. Shekem Matzina Mimalka Yisrael says that this is something that we found that the kings of Israel, you look at the kingdom of David, the kingdom of Shmuel, not Shmuel, Shlomo, you see that they also had the ability to carry out extrajudicial punishments, like the David punishing the Ger HaMaleki, who told him about, you know, Shaul's death and how he killed Shaul, for example, in order to maintain law and order so that things would not get out of hand. And he says this is the idea. It means this governmental power to institute law and order is something that was given over to the Bati Din. It was given over to the rabbinical courts in a different in different communities. And he says it's the same governmental power that every government has. Every government has the ability to impose penalties for the sake of maintaining law and order. So when you had autonomous Jewish communities that were given the authority by the local government to institute punishments and to carry out capital punishment, put people in prison, and give them lashes, do all of these things, even when we didn't otherwise have a full functioning, you know, Bezdin according to Torah law. So we had the ability to do all of these things as an exercise of governmental function of Makin Ve'onshin Shlo Min Adin. You would have child molesters in the community, so we could put the child molesters in jail. We can make sure that they're kept out of harm's way in terms of assaulting the children and innocent people within the community. We had that function. We would have the ability to do that from the standpoint of Tikkun Olam. But you look at what the Torah had said, if we don't have the ability to do them because the people are gangsters or because we simply don't have that governmental authority, as the Dvar Avraham points out, we're not given that type of governmental authority. So then we have to take advantage of the criminal system that does have that governmental authority, and we would have the right to hand over these individuals, as the poskim explain, as Rav Yashiv himself explains in a tshuva that he wrote about this subject. You know that somebody is a child molester, you would be allowed to hand the person over in order to maintain what we refer to as a tikkun olam, as the Rashba had said, mikiyum olam. So it's the same idea, what we call tikkun olam, in order to make sure that we have a normal functioning and just a society where criminals are not allowed to have a free rein to just go and commit terrible transgressions, and where we can keep our children safe in this particular context. So that is one source that would justify apprehending those who are child molesters and handing them over to the government, because this is a function of Mishpatei HaMelucha, of the right of the government to maintain law and order, and our own communal responsibility to do so. If we don't have the jurisdiction to do so, so then it's appropriate to utilize the criminal authorities for this purpose. That's source number one. Source number two is alluded to, if you go back for a moment to the bottom of page one, the very same Rashba that was quoted by the Beis Yosef. The Rashba says, V'kol shekei medika hormen and demalka. He says that you certainly have the ability to carry out the penalties when it is something which is included within the responsibility imposed upon you by the government. What does that mean? Let's say that the government mandates that certain individuals report incidents of child abuse or child molestation. What's that called? A mandated reporter, right? Let's say that you're a mandated reporter. You're a teacher and you know that there was a child abuse, you know that there's child molestation. So when there's Herman and Demalka, so then for sure you have the ability, even responsibility to apprehend criminals. What's the story that the Rashba alludes to? It's a story in the Gemara of Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon. If you turn to page 2 again, the source, Hay, tells the story of how Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon became a district attorney. You see, all the rabbis, many of them had other vocations. They weren't only rabbis. They did things. You know, some of them were carpenters, or some of them were shoemakers, right? Rabbi Yochanan HaSandler. So Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon was also a district attorney. How did he become a district attorney? Because the local police were trying to apprehend thieves. They were trying to apprehend robbers. And he was very good. Jewish robbers in the community, right? You know, figure that there have been over the years, there have been Jewish robbers, gangsters, you know, Dutch Schultz, whatever. So he was, very good at being able to spot who the Jewish robbers were and giving advice to the government of how they would be able to identify who the real robbers were. And the government said, you're so good at this, we're going to appoint you to be the district attorney. So that's what he started doing. So he started to hand over all of the robbers to the government. And in those days, the government didn't just put the robbers in jail for a couple of weeks or just give them a slap on the wrist. They would often kill them. So despite the fact that, according to our tradition, the robbers would not get the death penalty, they would actually get the death penalty. Nonetheless, Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon felt that he was asked to do this, and he's taking care of it. So Rabbi Yeshua, if you go to the last, to the end of the three lines to the bottom of this excerpt, Shachle Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha, Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha turned to Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, and said, what do you think you're doing? Chometz ben Yayin, you vinegar son of wine, meaning your father was Rabbi Shimon, he was a good guy, but you're vinegar, because you're doing terrible things. An Masayat HaMoyse Amo Shalom Kenel Ariga, you're giving over, you're being Moser, you're giving over the Jewish people, it's true, Jewish gangsters, but still, you're giving over members of the Jewish community to be killed. That's not nice. So Shalach Lei, so he said, yeah, but I'm giving over the gangsters. Kotsimani Machalim in a Kerem. I'm giving over the robbers. I'm giving over the thorns. I'm getting rid of the thorns from our vineyard. Don't you want to have a vineyard without thorns? A vineyard without thorns is much nicer than a vineyard with thorns. I'm getting rid of the thorns. I'm uprooting the thorns. So Shalach Lei, Rabbi Shimon ben Korcha said, Yavo Bala Kerem Yichalis Kotsim. Let the one who owns the vineyard, let him get rid of the thorns. Let HaKadosh Baruch Hu be the one who will eradicate the thorns. You don't have to be the one to do it. So the Rashba points out that this was just kind of like a friendly conversation. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Korcha wasn't saying that what you're doing is absolutely usher. The Gemara then tells the story that Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Yossi did the same thing as Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon. He also was a district attorney appointed by the government, and Eliyahu Hanavi used to appear to Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Yossi, and he ignored him. He gave him the cold shoulder for a period of time. He said, it's not nice. You should have run away rather than do this. He didn't say you should have given up your life rather than do this. He didn't say it was usher for you to do this. He said you should have tried to get out of it. So the Rashba points out, we see it would have been a midas chasidus, maybe a nice thing for a rabbi of the stature of Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, or a rabbi of the stature of Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Yossi, to avoid doing this sort of thing. However, it was not incumbent upon them to avoid doing this sort of thing. So we see that it's a perfectly permissible vocation to be a district attorney if you're handing over criminals, even if the punishment that's going to be imposed is a greater punishment. So the various poskims look at this Gemara and they say, well, in our case, if you're dealing with child molesters, number one, the offense that they are committing is worse, because it's not just that they're stealing people's money, they're actually violating people's bodies. And number two, the punishment that they're receiving is not as bad. They're not being put to death. If anything, they'll just be placed in prison for a number of years. But child molesters are not put to death. We don't have any jurisdiction here in the country that puts them to death. So if it was permissible, strictly speaking, according to the Rashba, for Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon to do what he was doing, certainly it would be permissible to hand over the child molesters. And certainly if there's a Herman and Demalka, what does Herman and Demalka mean? That if you're in a position where you are a mandated reporter, where it's incumbent upon you, according to the government, to do so. So says Rav Elyashiv. Rav Elyashiv was presented with this question by Rafai Balkon. Rafai Balkon is a famous big rabbi in Brooklyn. He's the author of the Badei HaShulchan. Some of you may have read, you know, some of his books. Very, very fine author, Talmid Chacham, Posek. So Rafai Balkon had approached Rav Elyashiv about these issues, and Rav Elyashiv responded that, number one, it would be permissible to apprehend a child molester and hand them over based on the principle of Herman and Demalka, that it's something which the government wants you to do. And number two, he said, that even without Herman and Demalka, it's still appropriate as a matter of tikkun ha'olam and something which is important in order for us to keep our society intact. If we would have to worry that our children are going to be molested, the people who are child molesters can run about with unbridled and untrammeled and just violate and molest our children without any consequences. So that's going to cause a complete breakdown of our community. Nobody can feel safe in our shuls and our schools and our entire society. So of course you have to hand over child molesters. So this was the conclusion that he reached. The Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg Zatzal, was also approached about this question. He was approached with two different shilas. You look at source 16, Tez Zion, on page 4. So he was asked about, number one, if you have a parent who is violating a child. What does it mean, violating a child? That a father is having relations with his young daughter. It's actually kind of horrible to, like, you know, even envision these types of scenarios. I remember speaking to the late Dr. Abraham Tversky, Zichrono Levracha, and he's telling me that I wouldn't believe the types of things that he deals with, or he used to deal with, within our own communities, of incest in people's homes and things of that variety. So it's a pretty horrible and terrible thing to have to talk about, but it's a reality. These things do happen, and, you know, lo aleinu, but nonetheless, they have to be addressed properly. So Tzitz Eliezer was asked this question by none other than the Nishmas Avraham, Rav Avraham Sofer Avraham, who is the author of the Nishmas Avraham series on medical ethics and the like. So he was asked the question about a father who's having relations with his daughter, but he said, we're not worried that he's going to kill the daughter. And kan kshasha pikuach nefesh, is it appropriate to give over the father to the authorities when we're not worried that the daughter is going to get killed? Being raped is kind of a lot like getting killed. You're just getting killed over and over and over again. Another question that he asked him was, if you have hisolus minish amora began yelodim, where you have a counselor in a day camp, and this counselor in the day camp is sexually abusing the children, which unfortunately is also something that's been known to happen from time to time. So is there a problem of handing over the person to the governmental authority? So in addition to the various arguments that we've been mentioning up until now, regarding, for example, Tikkun HaOlam and regarding Herman and Demalka, he brings another argument. He says that there's a law of Rodev. Law of Rodev is that if you see that somebody is an intended or would-be murderer and they're running after an intended victim, so you can take out. You're supposed to take out the would-be murderer. If you can stop the would-be murderer by tackling him, then good enough. If you have to break his legs, then break his leg. You have to shoot him in the leg. And if the only way to stop the would-be murderer from committing murder is by murdering the would-be murderer, killing the would-be murderer, then you can even kill the would-be murderer in order to stop him from killing his intended victim. But says that Tzitz Eliezer, that's not only true about a would-be murderer, that's about a would-be rapist as well. If you have a would-be rapist, somebody is running after, you know, certainly if it would be a type of rape, that it would be a prohibition of incest, like a father who's running after his daughter for the purpose of raping his daughter, which is certainly a case of incest. So he said, you're allowed to kill the father. You could actually kill this man in such a case. If you're allowed to use lethal force in order to stop him from committing this offense, then you certainly can use the force of reporting him to the authorities at the same time. So therefore, he says that that's not going to be a problem in any of these cases. Then he also addresses the case of the counselor. So in the case of the counselor, he said, well, sometimes it's going to be, depending on the circumstances, it might be in the same category as as a prohibited sexual relationship. Like, for example, if it's going to be a male counselor who's sodomizing his male campers, certainly if they're of the age of Bia, of the age where they could have sexual relations, the 9 years or above, so that is an offense which is punishable by death. So therefore, that would be in the same category. But even if it wasn't an offense which would be punishable by death, we have in the arena of Moser, in the arena of the halacha that is codified in Shulchan Aruch, in Simen Shin Pei Ches and Choshen Mishpat, of how you're normally not allowed to hand somebody in to the authorities because we're afraid that the person is going to be mistreated by the authorities and so forth. He said that this prohibition of Mesira, which the Gemara speaks about in, you know, as saying a person who Moser gives a Jew to the criminal authorities doesn't have a portion in the world to come, and you can even kill the person to stop them from committing this type of offense, the Gemara indicates. That is referring to, he said, when the individual does not pose a threat to society. However, if the person is Metzer as Harabim, and this is based on a Rambam, that the Rambam says explicitly that if the person is Metzer as Harabim, the person is a public nuisance, so then it is perfectly appropriate and perfectly warranted to hand the person over to the criminal authorities. And that is, if you take a look at source Yud on page 3, the Rambam says, this is in the third line, V'chein kol ha-meitzer le-tzibor, somebody who is causing distress to the community, they're doing acts which are a terrible, which cause terrible anguish, which cause the terrible oppression to the community. Certainly somebody who's molesting children in the community would fall into this category. Umetzai or Osan is causing them terrible, terrible distress. Mutal Namosro Biad Goyim, you're allowed to hand over such a person to the non-Jews, the non-Jewish authorities. Lakoso, to exact punishment, physical punishment upon the person, la osro, to lock the person up in jail, la conso, and to penalize the person. All the things that would be in the realm of possibility, certainly locking the person up in jail. Just as the Gemara in Gittin, which is source 9, and Dav Zayinim and Aleph, that speaks about Mar-Ukva, that Mar-Ukva had an individual or certain people who were giving him a very hard time, and he was just one person, he wasn't an entire community, and these people weren't physically assaulting him, they were just kind of making his life, you know, difficult through different statements that they were making and things of that variety. So he asked Rabbi Elazar what to do. Rabbi Elazar said, just pray for them to be punished by God, and God took care of it, the Gemara tells us, but you're not allowed to hand the person over to the criminal authorities yourself. Why is that? So the Rambam says, because Ma'ukva was only one person, therefore it wasn't completely considered to be a community nuisance. And the other posts can point out, Ma'ukva wasn't being physically assaulted. If you take a look at the Sma, in his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, that source Yud Aleph, in Simen Shin Pei Ches Siv Katan Lamed, so the Sma says that if the person is not just giving you Tsar the Alma, he's not just, you know, giving you a hard time, but the person's making your life difficult because he's taking money away from you. And certainly if he's assaulting your physical body, so then if the only way you can protect yourself, even if you're only an individual and not an entire community, you're one individual that is being molested by this individual, and the individual is not molesting other people, it doesn't matter. If in order to protect yourself, you need to hand the person over, you need to register a criminal complaint, get an order of protection, a temporary restraining order, whatever else, then it would be perfectly permissible for you to do so. So therefore, says the Tzitz Eliezer, you also have the consideration that people who are engaged in child molestation, certainly a counselor in a camp, my goodness, is Meitzer Sarabim, is really a community nuisance. And even if only one person was affected, that person would be allowed to take measures, presumably others even on that person's behalf, in order to prevent them from having to endure and suffer this type of physical assault. The Aruch HaShulchan, the Tzitz Eliezer goes further, he quotes in Aruch HaShulchan. He quotes in Aruch HaShulchan who says that there really isn't Mesira nowadays. If you have a just government with a just system of laws, And their punishment to child molesters is consistent with our Torah ethos. So that's not what the Gemara was talking about, or what the Shulchan Aruch was talking about when it spoke about the prohibition of Mesira, when it spoke about the prohibition of handing over a Jew to the criminal authorities. That prohibition is if you're dealing with like a gangster government that unfairly discriminates against the Jews. When you hand somebody over for one little offense, so they'll use that as a pretense, as a pretext to be able to take all the money away from this Jew and to put this Jew to death and to take away the estate from this person, even when it's completely not warranted. But if the person has really committed a crime and the government that we're talking about is a just government with a fair system of criminal laws that doesn't discriminate against the Jewish people, so then the Aruch HaShulchan thought that there may not be a violation of Mesira nowadays altogether. Now, not everybody agreed with that Aruch HaShulchan. The Aruch HaShulchan is in source Tesvav, and some people thought that the Aruch HaShulchan may have only been writing that for the censors when he said that. If you look, it's a very interesting lashon in the Aruch HaShulchan. He says all these laws regarding Mesira, this only has to do with certain places like Meza Medinos Me Africa. That's like certain, like a certain barbarian African nations that existed during his time, but doesn't apply to like good countries. Like the European countries, which was so nice to the Jews in his time. And especially the Russian Tsar, my goodness, bless his soul. And all of the Russian Tsars, they were so wonderful. And the kings of Britain. So some say that if he really was only writing this for the censors, then he only would have written it with respect to the Russian Tsar. But he wouldn't have written it with respect to the Britain kings, the English kings, because what did he have to do with the English kings? He lived in Lithuania. So the fact that he mentioned Malke Britannia, so that Tzitz Eliezer says, this shows that he wasn't only writing it for the censors. But I don't know, maybe he was only writing it for the censors. But it doesn't matter. Even if he was only writing it for the censors, the other argument that it is permissible to go to the criminal authorities to protect yourself from physical assault, and certainly to protect the community from somebody who's committing physical assault, is one which is a very strong argument that nobody could really disagree with. If you look in the Pisrei Choshen in source Yudalid, he clearly goes along with this idea as well. He says, look at the second line of Fizanir, Kesha'adam Muskov, if a person is being physically assaulted, or Filikushayeshal Shash Savir, Shomayn Lios Muskov, or even when he has a very legitimate concern that he or she is about to be physically assaulted, the Koshkin Gishazem, I am a love the Hargo of Filahakosa, and certainly when the person is being threatened, then Yachli Natsabof and Akir, and they can't just go to the Bezin and say, protect me. We at the Bezin, we try to protect people. One of our jobs is the Hatzel Oshet Mianoshko to help and defend the defenseless against their oppressors, but we don't have the ability to issue orders of protection. We don't have the ability to provide police protection, to put people in jail and do those sort of things. So therefore, in such a case, Mutlul Lazik Mishtara, the person is allowed to go to the police. Even though even though the attacker is going to then be held criminally liable, be penalized and put into jail, nonetheless, that's okay. Because you're allowed to do that in these circumstances. Person does not have to take them in front of the Bezin, because the Bezin simply doesn't have the power to punish or to prevent this type of assault. And therefore, he says that in order to prevent this type of offense from occurring, it would be permissible for all these reasons to go to the court. And Rav Yashu says exactly the same thing. You take a look in source 22, Chof Beis. I have a lot of sources that deal with Mesira in general, but if you look at source Chof Beis, when Rav Yashu was asked this question, so Rav Yashu says very, very clearly, this is in the Tshuva in the middle of page 9, he quotes the Rashba, and you take a look at the second to last paragraph on the page, Mitok Divrei Rashba Shaminan, De Bedava Sheesh Ba Meshub Tikkun Olam, Yesh Koch Lechak Meisua, Shebechol Dor Vedor Ligdor Gedev Lamad Beperetz Kamak Meshein Lanot Siva Shohona Demalka, even if there would be no mandated reporting, if it's for purposes of Tikkun Olam, he says, for maintaining stability in our society, it would be perfectly permissible in such a case to authorize for the offender, the molester, to be handed over to the criminal authorities. However, Rabbi Yashiv has the following very important caveat, and this is a difficult caveat, and this is where it gets kind of iffy and sticky. He says, Achen, this is the last line of page 9. He says, Achen, kol zeh, that's when it's very clear that the person is molesting. So then you have Mishum Tikkun Olam. And I would say that the Beis Din itself and the community, the Rabbanim of the community, can even delineate what are the parameters. It doesn't only have to be a case of Rodev. Even if it's inappropriate touching and the like, which is criminal in nature, where it doesn't run to the point of sodomization, it doesn't run to the point where there is full-fledged intercourse taking place, but it's still inappropriate physical behavior. So a Beis Din can say that if it's in the category of criminal, we're not going to tolerate. That also is something which is very harmful to our community if that type of activity is taking place, and we'll authorize those cases to be handed over to the criminal authorities too. But it turned to the top of page 10, says Rav Yoshev, ach, be'ofen she'en afilu reglayim ledover, but if you don't even have circumstantial evidence, eleiza dimyon, but it's just somebody's like imagination that a Rebbe is just, friendly and gives, a hug to a Talmud in a way that is not suggestive of any kind of molestation. It's just a conventionally acceptable hug. Like, you hug a Talmud at his chuppah. I think that's considered to be socially acceptable. You do something which is socially acceptable and it's just viewed as somehow, some type of an act of molestation. If you're going to allow somebody to just hand over people for things that are not really a legitimate provocation, not only is that not fixing the world, that's destroying the world, that because maybe this Talmud has some bad feelings towards his Rebbe, so therefore he's going to make up some sort of a story about his Rebbe, or he's going to exaggerate something to the point of craziness, and he's going to ruin the Rebbe's life in the process, when nothing bad was done. So that for sure he says he has no heter. Now, the truth of the matter is, if you take a look at the Shiloh that was posed to Rav Yoshev, he was asked two things. He was said, if you have a case of definite child molestation, can you hand the person over to the authorities? He said, yes. And then he was asked, what if it's only Raglayim Ladova? What if it's only circumstantial evidence? So what did Rav Yoshev not answer? He didn't answer the second question. Instead, he said, well, if there's not even circumstantial evidence, then for sure you can't hand over somebody to the criminal authorities in such a case. He did not deal with the case of the circumstantial evidence altogether. I don't know if that's a deliberate, dodge. Chassid Shalom, I don't think he was the type to dodge, but Lemaise, at the end of the day, Rav Yoshev didn't seem to address that particular issue, and that has become really a much more difficult area of discussion. What do you do with sort of like these hard intermediate cases? So some say, well, if it's the hard intermediate cases, so you need to have some sort of a review board before you're going to turn someone over to the criminal authorities and potentially ruin their life. So maybe you need to have, a much more careful and assiduous process of vetting out, the real claims from the claims that don't necessarily pass muster or aren't necessarily sufficient for a criminal prosecution. So you could argue, no, just hand everybody over at the slightest provocation and the slightest suspicion, because if the person's innocent, they're going to be exonerated anyway. So the truth of the matter is, I'm not sure, because we live in a society where sometimes that there are very, very charged emotions when it comes to these things, and a person could be held to be guilty, even if maybe they're not, fully guilty, or their offenses could be exaggerated in people's minds. So it's not really such a simple thing. Or you say that, well, in most of the cases, and I've been told this by psychologists who work within the from community and deal with these types of cases and these types of claims and so forth, most of the time when there's smoke, there's fire. Most of the time when people come forward and they allege molestation, so then there really is molestation. So maybe statistically that's true. But just because statistically that's true, that doesn't mean that in any particular case where it might not be true, that you have to operate with the assumption that a person is guilty until proven innocent. So I think that that argument also doesn't really work completely. And then the third argument is, well, there's the Gemara Nida. The Gemara Nida says that this talks about the story of Gedaliah ben Achikam, right? The last, governor of Jerusalem. So he was told that there's somebody out, this guy Yochanan, who's out to kill you. I'm sorry, this guy Yishmael, excuse me, Yochanan was the one who told him. He says, fellow Yishmael is out to kill you. And Gedaliah didn't want to believe Lashon Hara, because why should he believe Lashon Hara? So he didn't take steps to protect himself, and as a result, he got killed by this fellow Yishmael. So the Gemara says that even though you're not supposed to accept Lashon Hara, mechash mi abay, but you have to be worried that maybe it's true. So therefore, so some say, well, you still have to be worried, even if it turns out that these accusations of molestation aren't true, you have to be worried that maybe they're true. Yes. But the worry that maybe it's true does not, as the Maharsha points out, the Maharik points out, it doesn't permit you to take decisive action against somebody because maybe the accusations are not true. It just means that until it's proven one way or another, you have to be careful. You have to be cautious. Maybe you put the person on leave, paid leave or something until the accusations can be investigated properly. But it doesn't mean that you immediately come to the conclusion that the person is guilty or that you're going to throw the book at them immediately. So you have to be very, very careful about this. So maybe what's instructive is looking at the way that Rav Elyashiv answered the other question. The other question posed to Rav Elyashiv, same question posed to the Tzitz Eliezer by Rav Avraham Sofer. Maybe they were asked at the same time. I don't know. But the question was, what about a case where you're concerned that a child is being abused? A child is being not molested, but is being physically abused by the parents. And if you're going to report the parents to the child authorities, they're going to take the child away from the parents' home. The parents have a religious home. They're probably going to chase them. They may likely place the child in a foster home that's not religious at all, and then the child's not going to be in a Torah atmosphere. What's more important, to be safe from physical blows or to be in a Torah atmosphere? Well, obviously, to be safe from physical blows. I don't really understand the question. But that was the question that was posed. The answer, said Rav Elyashiv, he said, well, if the person, we're afraid that the person's going to go into a non-religious home, so it's almost like giving the child over to a avodah zarah, so that's a really serious issue. So he said, but if we're dealing with pikuach nefesh, so then, like I've mentioned, there's nothing to discuss. The child's life is in danger, so then that overrides every other concerning consideration. It doesn't matter. Wherever the child's going to be placed, you just want to take the child out of harm's way. Rav Elyashiv does say that. But then Rav Elyashiv said, Yesh gam lishko begedah shlisolus, shebashkafesh lemi acheres agam mishalanu. He said, molestation is molestation. When I'm dealing with child abuse, like different types of discipline or different types of what's considered to be child neglect, the perspective of the secular world might not be identical every single time with the perspective of from society. Maybe, a person might make a mistake or whatever. They might, do something which is considered appropriate discipline from the perspective of Torah, not from secular society. He was concerned about that. So therefore, when it came to the case of child abuse, I'm just saying what he said. I understand where he's coming from on some level. So in every single accusation of this sort, he said, again, if it's not a case of pikuach nefesh, different story. But if it's not a case of pikuach nefesh, then he says, so you really need to have tamid chachamim, you need to have gedol Yisrael, who are going to weigh in with respect to whether this rises to the level of really reporting the parents. Said the Tzitz Eliezer, when the Tzitz Eliezer was presented with this question, this was the first question that he was presented that was posed to him. So he said as well that if there is really a concern that the child's life is in danger, so then he said that of course you have to report the parents, and this is the paramount concern. And who says that the child's going to end up in a non-observant home anyway? Maybe they'll end up being in an observant home. But he says, if there is no real concern about pikuach nefesh, so then he said that then he says that it would not be permissible in his opinion. So this becomes sort of a very difficult, analysis as well, where you really have to have a sense of of the experts to have the benefit of knowing when a child really is objectively speaking being abused and when steps have to appropriately be taken. Now here you also have the Herman and DeMalka argument. If you have a social worker, you have a school nurse, you have a teacher who really sees that there's genuine abuse going on, and they're expert at being able to detect it. So in addition to the other arguments, they also have the mandated reporter requirement. So therefore, you have that argument as well as to why it would be appropriate to report under those circumstances. But are these easy cases? They're really not easy cases. The question is there a role for Bezdin to play when you have, for example, number one, cases that are sort of iffy in nature, where there's not really clear molestation going on? Maybe there's inappropriate touching, maybe things of that variety. Maybe there are things which wouldn't even necessarily go to the criminal authorities altogether, but nonetheless are considered to be inappropriate according to our standards. When we talk about, like, who's going to be fit to be a teacher of our children, think about the Gemara Nedarim and Daf Lamed Zayin. The Gemara Nedarim and Daf Lamed Zayin talks about why is it that Torah teachers have the right to be paid. They're doing a mitzvah. Moshe Rabbeinu taught Torah, ma'anim b'chinam afatem b'chinam, right? Moshe Rabbeinu taught Torah for nothing. He didn't take money. He didn't charge money for teaching Torah. So on what basis do we have the ability to take money? So the Gemara says that there are two possibilities, either because we're not only teaching Torah, we're teaching the students, you know, grammar, how to, you know, lay in the trup when they read the words of the Torah, pisutamim, or alternatively, schar shimur, that we're getting paid for babysitting. If one of the main justifications as to why we pay our teachers is because they're babysitting, what kind of babysitting is it if you're going to be molesting the children? So obviously you can't have teachers who are going to be engaged in inappropriate touching when it comes to interacting with children. So even if something's not criminal in nature, it still may be appropriate for the rabbinic authorities to take some sort of action. But if it's not something which otherwise falls within the province of Bezdin, so what do you do if you're a community and you're trying to deal with all of these types of cases? What they did in Chicago, and what really other communities have tried to set up and duplicate or establish, but it hasn't really been as successful as the mechanism that we set up here in Chicago, is to have a special Bezdin that's set up specifically for the purpose of dealing with these types of cases. Well, Halberstam, in the article that he wrote in Yeshurun, said that for most types of cases, if a person's summoned by one Bezdin, they can say, oh, I want to go to a different Bezdin. But he said, here, the idea is to establish a Bezdin that has specific expertise in this area, that consults with the therapist, that's in touch with the criminal authorities to the extent necessary to, you know, to deliberate with them as to whether a certain case should be reported, shouldn't be reported, so that the Bezdin itself is in a position of responsibility where it's dealing with the police, it's dealing with the therapist, it's really trying to figure out the appropriate way to deal with the case with all of the expert authorities that are assisting them in the process. And this becomes the Bezdin Kavur. You can't say, oh, I want to go to a different Bezdin. There has to be a specific Bezdin that becomes expert in dealing with these types of cases. So this was established in Chicago a number of years ago. Rav Schwartz, as that's all, sat on this. I think Rabbi Levine was involved at the time. This is before I came to Chicago. And today, I know that we have this Bezdin with Rabbi First Shlita, Rabbi Zev Cohn, Shlita, and myself. And we've sat on a number of different cases throughout, you know, over the last number of years. Don't worry, it's not like dozens. But, you know, a few cases that come up where there are sort of kind of like these iffy questions of trying to figure out exactly what's going on. Is it something? Sometimes the answer is that we say this has to go to the criminal authorities immediately. And it's important for us to get the message out to the community that if there is clear molestation going on, then of course you have to go to the criminal authorities immediately in order to protect people from harm. But sometimes it's kind of like, you know, a little bit iffy. There's somebody who needs a little bit of help with this and that. There's something in a relationship that's not quite molestation, but it's not quite perfect either, and appropriate steps, you know, have to be taken and the like. You do need to have some sort of a board that serves as a gatekeeper for dealing with, you know, these types of accusations, because if you didn't have it, many of these cases, the people wouldn't go to the criminal authorities because it doesn't rise to that level. But as a result, it wouldn't be addressed properly in order to keep people properly, you know, safe, and in order to ensure that certain individuals are kept out of positions of interacting with children and positions of authority in the community and things of that variety, because they could potentially be dangerous, or at the very least, they could be inappropriate. And therefore, these are the types of cases where I have found, even though I was initially a skeptic, to be perfectly honest, because it seems much neater and easier to say, oh, just, you know, send everything to the criminal authorities, I have found that there is a value in having a bezin for these types of things. It's also a value in the following sense. You know, I was called by one of the leaders of the Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah a number of years ago, who complained about how we didn't have enough batei din set up to deal with these issues. And I said, but, you know, when it comes to, like, criminal punishment, we can't deal with that. So he said, yeah, but very often it's not just the criminal punishment. It's the people who are suffering for years and years because they really need medical help. They need, you know, constant therapy. And they need to have the right to, the ability to go to Beis Din in order for Beis Din to impose a ripoy, you know, the rapo yirapay, to impose medical costs upon the molester for the harm that was caused. So I said that it's difficult to bifurcate the cases, because if we can't deal with a criminal case, we can't really deal with the monetary claims independent of the criminal case if they sort of go together. So we would need for the criminal authorities to decide the criminal case, and if the monetary penalties or payments go together with that, so we can't really take one and not the other. But sometimes you don't have a criminal case altogether, either because it doesn't rise to criminal level, it's past the statute of limitations, or you have cases where the criminal case has already been decided, meaning that it has been found that the person was a molester. Maybe they went to jail, maybe there was, you know, some other type of a disposition of the case, but now it's a few years later, and now the person wants to bring a separate action. We don't have to adjudicate whether the molestation took place. That was already adjudicated. Our job is just to adjudicate how much money does the molester owe to the individuals who were molested in terms of medical costs, therapies, things of that variety. So that is something that's appropriate for a Beis Din to adjudicate. What some of the writers have suggested is that, for example, when you have contracts that people, you know, enter into to become, for example, to be employees of a school, that they would sign in the contract that in the event that there would ever be, you know, any type of accusation against them or any type of liability, they agree to submit to whatever payments would be imposed by the following Beis Din, so that there already is a submission for adjudication and the giving of authority to the Beis Din to impose these types of costs. One has to examine these types of clauses, especially with some of the recent limitations that have been imposed by federal law and the like to arbitration clauses in cases of sexual harassment and the like. Here, the idea of the clause is to protect the victim, not to protect the offender. So this type of a clause might, in fact, you know, be enforceable and might be a good thing to the extent that you would have these types of clauses in teacher contracts. What about if the only testimony that is being presented is testimony from the victims themselves? So it's very interesting. The Shoal Umeshiv, this is Rav Yosef Shoal Nathanson, who was a posek in the mid-19th century, dealt with this issue. This is not something which is only a new type of situation. Look at the very, very last source, that source, Chav Dalet, pages 10 to 11. The Shoal Umeshiv dealt with a case of a school teacher who was accused of sodomizing children, young boys, who are under the school teacher's care. And originally, they didn't want to hear the testimony of the children because they were underage at the time that the alleged sodomization took place. They were below the bar mitzvah age. They weren't kosher edim, right? They weren't kosher edim. When he was accused, he said, I am, you know, shocked and outraged that I'm being, because often the people are shocked and outraged. He said, I'm shocked and outraged that I'm being accused of, you know, this type of action, and my good name is being sullied. I'm leaving town right now. So there, that'll serve you right. So he left town, and then he got a job as a mechanic in another town. And then the rumor got around to the other town that he had been accused of these various things. And one of the balabatim in the new town wrote a letter to the abezin of the first town saying, well, whatever happened to that case? And the abezin said, oh, nothing ever came of the case. They figured, okay, great. So we can hire this guy, and it's okay for him to be a rebbe. So now that the case came to the Shoal Umeshiv, because what happened was that these young boys actually ended up testifying. Once they became older, one of them was now 16, one of them was 13, they were overage, and they were testifying about what happened to them when they were children, when they were minors. Now, as a general rule, you're not allowed, believed as a matter of halacha, to provide edus, to testify when you're above bar mitzvah about something that happened to you when you're below bar mitzvah, unless it's something which is only a rabbinic law. Certainly invalidating a person from being a qualified teacher, from being a kosher aide and the like, that's a Torah type of consequence. So therefore, technically their edus wouldn't have been valid. So the Sholem Eishet quoted from a ruling of the Truma Sedeshin, which is codified by the Ramah, in Simon Laman Hay and Choshen Mishpat, which says that if you have an offense that takes place in a location where the only people who could possibly be witnesses are people who are not otherwise kosher to be witnesses, like, for example, there's an assault in the women's section. The only people who are going to be there are women, we would hope, in the women's section, right? And the women are not generally considered to be valid witnesses as a matter of halacha. Or you have something like this, where the only people who could have witnessed what happened were children, were underage children. So then their testimony is accepted. So therefore, he says, this is a case where this type of molestation of young children, you're not going to call people to be present while it happens. The only people who are going to be in the bedroom at the time will be the molester and the child who is being molested. So therefore, he said, in such a case, you have to be willing to accept the testimony. He says, it's not for purposes of accepting the testimony that you're going to invalidate this person for good. You can't say, you know, for sure that this would be testimony that would be kosher on a Torah level, but at least on a rabbinic level, we would consider it to be satisfactory evidence for purposes of removing this person from his job and saying that this person is not fit to be a Torah teacher. So that's what the Sholem Eishet ruled. He said that this person is not fit to be a Torah teacher. So I actually cited the Sholem Eishet in an article that I wrote at one point in time, and somebody wrote, actually the son of Rabbi Feivel Cohen, wrote a letter saying, how can you consider the children to be proper witnesses when they're actually testifying about themselves? They're testifying about something that happened to them, aren't they? A nogeya bedover. So I pointed out that there's a halacha, I responded, and I pointed out that there is halacha in Shulchan Aruch in Siman Lamedala that says, you're permitted, a person is permitted to say the following individual raped me. You're allowed to say that. You can even say the following person sodomized me, okay, just to be explicit about it. And I was a willing participant. And if two people testify about that, then the person can be, you know, according to the Rambam, the person who committed the sodomy can be put to death for that. Why is that? So because we say palgin and dibure, that you're believed to testify with respect to the other person, not necessarily to testify about yourself. What the post can point out is that with respect to, and here, you're not even saying anything about, you're saying that you were assaulted. So the Ramah says that a person who was stolen from can identify the thief. They're allowed to identify the thief, and you could prosecute the thief on that basis. The only thing is that if the only way that we identify the thief is by virtue of the victim pointing out the thief, so the Ramah does have one caveat, and this might have halakha l'maaseh ramifications, and I thanked Rabbi Cohen Jr., Rabbi Binyamin Cohen, for pointing this out. I said that what the Ramah says in such a case, you would punish, for example, in the case of the thief, you could punish the thief, however, not for purposes of providing restitution to the person who was the victim. Because if the only way that we know that this person was, you know, the victim of this thief is by the victim's own identification, so the victim can't get enough from it, then he really is testifying for his purposes. But if it's only for purposes of removing this individual from harm's way, so that this individual won't be able to harm other people, so then the testimony is perfectly valid. So maybe in that case, where the only way that we know that the molestation occurred was through the testimony of the one who was molested, maybe in that case, the one who was molested wouldn't be able to bring an action to recover medical costs. If the only way in which we were condemning the molester is on the basis of this person's testimony, so it should be abundantly clear that this person's not going to get a benefit from it. I'm not 100% sure about that, because Rav David Cohen then wrote his own response. Rav David Cohen, who's the rabbi of Gavul Yabitz in Brooklyn, wrote his own response. He's very active when it comes to these cases of child molestation, and he wrote his own response to this letter by Rabbi Binyamin Cohen that was written in response to an article that I had written. And Rav David Cohen said that he had a totally different approach. His approach was, what's the reason that we are acting upon these cases, that we are authorizing reporting to the criminal authorities, and that we are being so proactive with respect to child molestation cases? He said it's because of Tikkun Olam. It says it's because, as the Rashba had said, it's for purposes of maintaining law and order in society. When we're maintaining law and order in society, what did the Rashba also say? He said that we don't follow the normal laws of testimony. We don't follow the law and normal laws of testimony. So then what that means is that it's all completely at the discretion of the rabbinical court, the communal rabbinic authorities, and so forth, to determine what type of a testimony are we comfortable with under the circumstances. And if we are going to be comfortable with the testimony of the children talking about what happened to themselves, because the psychologists, the therapists, the experts will say that this is reliable, so then that could be reliable even for all purposes, even for purposes presumably of being able to pursue damages for recovering medical costs and the like. So he went further than, you know, I was being apologetic and, you know, and so forth, and deferential, because I wanted to, you know, be, you know, completely, you know, honest about the sources and so forth. But Rabbi David Cohen also pointed out, be honest about the sources, but one of the major sources here is the source of the Rashba, that we're not following the normal rules of testimony altogether. So these are, you know, some of the issues that, you know, come up in, you know, the context of these types of cases. One has to be so, so careful because, as I mentioned, on the one hand, you have to preserve the integrity of the community. You must preserve the welfare of the children in the community. We all have a major, major responsibility in that regard. We all are responsible for our own children. We're responsible for all the children in the community to put the measures in place in order to make sure that they're safe. But we also have to make sure people aren't unfairly prosecuted and that we have appropriate mechanisms for being able to review the things that need to be reviewed and to be able to deal with the things that only we, in our rabbinic capacity, have the capability to deal with appropriately. So that's just, again, you know, a general summary of some of the issues of the topic. I haven't touched upon everything, and I just wanted to, you know, just give a certain, you know, brief overview and perspective. Okay.
Wow.
Stop it.
So you made it very clear that the best thing to pursue extraordinary